The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly, I'm Jason Solomons. This week we cast our critical eyes over the newly announced nominations for this year's Academy Awards. We speak to the teams behind two of the nominated films, Chico and Rita and Helen Back Again. They're both British, who knew? Guardian critic Zam Brooks is here as we review one of those Oscar nominees, The Descendants, starring George Clooney. We'll also look at Clive Owen in a horror flick, Intruders, and Liam Neeson is in the wastelands of Alaska after a plane crash in The Grey. And we'll talk to Drake Doremus, director of the college love story Like Crazy. Hold on to your black box in-flight recorders, it's Film Weekly.
Fat Charlie the Archangel sloped into the moon. He said, I have no opinion about this, and I have no opinion about that.
Hello, everybody. This morning, we will share the news we've all been waiting for.
That was the unlikely duo of Tom Sherrack and the lovely Jennifer Lawrence announcing the nominations for this year's Oscars, which dominated the film world this week. Martin Scorsese's Hugo picked up a whopping 11 and The Artist got 10, with The Descendants trailing behind with 5 nominations. So the 9 films, yes, 9 for some unknown reason, on the Academy's Best Picture list this year are The Artist, The Descendants, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, The Help, Hugo, Midnight in Paris, Moneyball, Tree of Life, and War Horse. So among other surprises was the inclusion of Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. There's A Better Life's Demian Bashir included in the Best Actor list, which features Gary Oldman, but no Leonardo DiCaprio or Michael Fassbender. Rooney Mara made it onto the Best Actress category, while Nick Nolte and Max von Sydow slug it out for the grisliest of the surprise nods in the supporting actor field. Joining me now is Zan Brooks to discuss the nominations. Welcome, Zan. Hugo got 11 nominations.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
It is amazing, isn't it? I mean, it makes it the front runner. I still don't think it's going to win anything like 11.
No, I think it could dominate the technical categories.
Yeah.
And it is interesting that the two front runners are both films about the early days of film.
Making films. I thought the Academy were there to support like the newness, like the multiplex, the 3D and all of that.
Well, I suppose the Academy are there to support the Academy and therefore to support cinema. And they're saying, we like cinema and these films like cinema.
Yeah.
They're saying how great cinema is. And yet, I think in terms of the balance, they've got it slightly out, that I think The Artist is a properly great film and Hugo really isn't.
Yeah, I liked Hugo, though.
Yeah,
I
you
say.
Did. You it liked it more than me. Spell, I thought it was a bit mechanical.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just that weird thing, again, of Martin Scorsese should have won endless Oscars in the sort of 70s and 80s. And now that he's gone a bit kind of mild and soft in the middle, the Academy now love him.
Do you think, we've talked about this before, that often the Academy like to pit one against the other, Hurt Locker versus Avatar, Social Network versus King's
Seems
Speech.
To be, yeah.
I was saying to you last week, I can't see what would go up against The Artist. The Artist versus Descendants doesn't seem like a fair battle, because The Artist seems like a Best Picture winner and Descendants never does. But when you've got Hugo in there, and I'm thinking, well, now we're getting interesting. Now, politically, that's actually quite interesting. We've got two films about the same thing, but one's made by an American favourite, one's made by some French people.
Yeah, I think that the Artist still goes in as the favourite. I don't think The Descendants is going to win this film.
No, it's not.
I was very happy to see Tree
Nor
of Life.
Nor any of the other... I know you like the
really
Tree of Life.
I was really pleased to see the Tree of Life in there, which got completely shut out of both the BAFTAs and the Globes.
Yes.
And Terrence Malick being in the hunt for Best Director. I think that's probably as far as it will go. I don't think that's going to win anything. Also really pleased to see Gary Oldman for Tinker Taylor.
Me too. I was like, he was the last one mentioned. I was like, brilliant.
Yeah.
God, he's in.
And again, he should win, but probably won't. Also, it's good to see Melissa McCarthy nominated for Bridesmaids.
I wanted to see Kristen Wiig in there.
Yeah, she should have been. I mean, the prejudice that Hollywood always seems to have is against comedies. That is seen as they wouldn't dirty their hands on a film that's funny. And yet Bridesmaids was properly good. And Melissa McCarthy, even though it's obviously an incredibly crude, vulgar role, it's a great comic performance.
No, she is actually like that, though.
She is, yeah. She is a bit. But so what, you know? Most actors...
I mean, who's going to watch this blimmin' Oscar ceremony, though. I mean, I'm looking at them. I mean, we all said it was a vintage year. 2011 was great. And I'm looking at these Best Picture nominees. And if I was like a kid in Nebraska, I'd be going, what a lot of rubbish this is.
It's weird, isn't it? You look at it and think, oh, so Drive didn't make it. Yeah. And neither did Shame. And neither did We Need to Talk About Kevin. Yeah. And all of these films that we've been kind of banging the drum for. Obviously, the Academy didn't hear us, and that's shocking.
I can't believe they don't download every week. But there are other films in there that I liked Woody Allen. But it seems that he hasn't made a bad film. Let's nominate him a lot.
Yeah, I think that's got, is it four nominations for that?
The regular screenplay one
for Woody Allen, and it has to be said that Midnight in Paris is his most commercially successful film ever. Mm.
And again, it's another film that harks back to the beginnings of cinema.
And what is this weird nostalgia kick that the Academy
is it that the present is unpalatable?
I think the present is scary. Possibly it's always scary, but I think particularly at the moment, with the economy being what it is. Yeah.
There's nothing going on. I mean, we had a series where we had a kind of few Oscars where there was political films. There was the Fahrenheit 9/11 ones. There was the anti-Iraq films. Then there was the sort of the Errol Morrissey. Then there was the Inside Job, the kind of financial disaster films.
Yeah.
And now it's like, what else are we going to have a go at?
Yeah, it's a very retro Oscars. I was glad to see A Separation both getting the nod for Best Foreign Language Film. I think it probably starts as favourite there, but also Best Original Screenplay.
Yeah, which it won at
which is really crossing out of the ghetto.
Week.
I mean, they normally totally ghettoise.
Yeah, it would have been good to, if they really want to promote them, they should put them in Best Picture.
Yeah, Best Actors. The acting in it was absolutely tremendous. Yeah.
Sara Bayat, one of our Best Supporting Actress. Nice to see J. Edgar completely shut out as well, because that bored the tears off
me.
That
was a terrible film.
Yeah, and don't you think that Leonardo DiCaprio just looked like, you know, Catherine Tate's nan all the time?
He did, yeah. He was buried, wasn't he? Buried under the prosthetics. Also, it's interesting that Meryl Streep obviously is nominated for The Iron Lady and is the runaway favourite for that, but the rest of the film has been basically shoved to the sidelines now, which is an admission that it's not a great film apart from her performance.
And yet, it's such a great performance dominates every scene of the film. Yeah. I love Meryl Streep in that. And I can't believe people saying, oh, there's a lot of love for Viola Davis. And I was like, no, come on. It's not even remotely the same. Unless, of course, she was played by Adam Sandler, in which case it's a genius performance.
It's a great performance. Give it to Sandler.
Now, we have sourced out some British nominees who've been nominated in various categories. A shout must go to my friend Lucy Walker, who was nominated last year for Wasteland, has been nominated again in the documentary short for the Tsunami and the Cherry Blossom, a little film which she made after last year's Oscars. She went after the tsunami in Japan and showed her camcorder around and did a bit of tourism, but I think made a great film out of the wreckage of that. So she's been nominated again 2 years in a row. Not many Brits managed to do that.
No, considering we've been going on about what a good year it's been for British cinema, the Academy obviously disagrees.
Yeah, you know, they gave it all to the King's Speech last year.
They gave it all to the King's Speech, but they probably shouldn't have done. I kept thinking Christopher Plummer was British, but of course he's Canadian. And I think it would be great to see him get the Best Supporting Actor Oscar.
Yeah, I'm really pleased that it was Albert Brooks. Right, I didn't like Albert Brooks in Drive.
No, I think he was wrong for it. It was too much of a big showy performance in a film that's utterly icy and restrained. Mm. It kind of blew out the levels a little bit. And I like Albert Brooks, but I prefer him in Finding Nemo.
Yeah, it was really good in that. Well, as I said, we're going to seek out some of the British nominees that you may not recognise. In fact, I didn't recognise it myself, because a film nominated for Best Documentary is Hell and Back Again, which we featured on the show when it first came out in UK cinemas. But I didn't know then that it was a British film. It was produced by Roast Beef Productions, who are Mike Lerner and Martin Herring, and they are with me now. Congratulations, guys. Oscar nominees.
Yeah, it's hard to believe.
That's fantastic.
You presumably documentaries, they sort of have they steal a little march because they have a long list. So you knew that you were in with the chance, Martin.
It was a long list. There were 15 films, so it narrowed the odds slightly, but we still weren't brave enough to go down to the bookies
and bet on yourselves. Mike, how did you feel? I mean, I don't know if this is your first Oscar nomination.
It is.
Yes, yeah. It's not something that happens every week.
No.
Your feelings then?
Well, just it's unbelievable. I mean, you have this, you know, this long list comes out, and so you, which is about a 6-week wait, so you dare to dream that you might, you know, obviously you're in with a chance, but. And as the days draw nearer, you know, it becomes more and more nerve-wracking and the possibility. And you know, quite frankly, you know, yesterday morning, horrible rainy morning, thought, oh, all right, well, let's just assume we're not going to get it. And then suddenly, there you are. So. Yeah.
And they don't announce you. I mean, did you watch the telecast?
Yeah, the telecast. But annoyingly, they don't announce. They only announce the first 10 nominations.
That's not my fault.
That's not your fault.
That's Tom Sherrick's fault. in the Academy.
So then suddenly it was there it was on in online. And,
So I mean, it's a Brit doc, which we often support, and you guys roast beef. But it is a story. Let's face it, of some Marines fighting the Taliban in Afghanistan, and then the story of Sergeant Nathan Harris, who we follow back to America after his severe injury, and see how he is coping with that. That's the basic story of To Hell and Back Again. How come you two British guys, film producers from London, are involved in this story?
Well, the answer is actually Richard Jobson, the director, who was working, the director of this film, Dan Fung Dennis, was working with Richard as a cinematographer. And we had made several films in Afghanistan before. We made a film called Afghan Star and Vote Afghanistan.
Which was the one about the sort of pop idol in
Pop
Afghanistan,
idol in Kabul.
Too.
Thanks. Yeah, that's a lovely film. And so, you know, we had a kind of Afghan chops, as it were, and experience with, you know, getting these feature docs made, which is not always easy. So Richard recommended to Dan Fung, he talked to us, and then we met us up in Sheffield, I believe. And
At the Doc Fest in Sheffield. And we go up to Sheffield, and we always say, well, you know, maybe that we go to those pitch meetings, we sort of say, well, maybe the next kind of big documentary is being born here today. So if we'd have gone the year before, an Oscar nominee was actually born out of one of those meetings.
He was there. He was giving a lecture, in fact, about his war photography with the Frontline Club, wasn't he, at the time?
Which we published quite often in The Guardian.
Yeah. And we'd seen the stuff. He'd worked with Richard quite closely, doing a lot of stuff with the 5D camera. Richard Jobson was at the forefront of pushing that technology as a film director here.
Really?
Dan Fung was close.
He used to present movie programmes.
He used to present 01 for London, where we all met.
Oh, right. Oh, I see. Yeah. That's where you've come from.
Jobson and Paula.
With that spiky sofa.
They were very close, and they were really interested in pushing this Canon technology. And Dan Fung was really, really out there with the technology. He was pushing it to places that people weren't really doing. Had a great eye as a press photographer anyway. He just arrived at that lecture in Sheffield with a handful of flashcards. So that's what you would have seen. You would have seen us haranguing Dan Fung in the corner of the Café Rouge in Sheffield's game.
But did he have the story that he was going to chronicle the Marines, like, you know, talking to the Taliban, trying to sort of win the hearts and minds, so to speak, in action, and then follow Nathan Harris home?
Well, at that stage, he'd done the Afghan bit, and he'd been embedded with this company Marines for several weeks, and just returned with this amazing combat footage, and as you say, these scenes with discussing matters with the villagers and all that, and really wasn't sure what to do next. So he went and he didn't know that Nathan had been injured until he returned to North Carolina, and they started coming back and realised that Nathan, you know, and then discovered Nathan had been injured, and in a way that suggested the story, in a way.
Because there's been a lot of documentaries about the Afghan war and the Iraq experience. There's also been feature films as well, which some of them have examined the sort of what they call the coming home side of it, the John Voight drama from Vietnam, that aspect. But never a documentary has actually sort of managed to balance the two. I mean, Hurt Locker, I suppose, which your film was compared to quite often, that had a scene with Jeremy Renner kind of trying to readjust to maybe shopping malls and kind of doing the aisles thing when he goes back. But there's a very brief scene. Your film kind of takes that, Matt, and makes that the centrepiece, Martin.
Well, I think that Dan Fung, once he'd got there and realised that Nathan was not getting off the bus with the homecoming troops, and he realised that there was something else up and found him, tracked him down, he, at the same time, really was decompressing in exactly the same way, at exactly the same pace as Nathan. And because of his profound embedding in the field, he was welcomed there and to do the same thing. And that's what gives it the sort of unique access, really, that he has to these couples' lives. It's incredible, and that he's achieved it by being one of the guys. The thing that the whole team has brought to it, really, is the fact that it is not overtly political film. It's not something where people are screaming about fighting.
No, it's very much a human film.
It's a human film, and anybody in America can claim it. And that's really the way we've started the delicate handling very early on, I think.
Mike and Martin, I must just ask you, that we have another film here, a documentary dealing with Iraq. Only a couple of years ago, Restrepo, which was a film embedded by a war photographer, Tim Hetherington. You've got Dennis Dangfun doing yours. Tim Hetherington, of course, as we all know, sadly, was injured and killed in action, in capturing his action. And it was almost as if, like, well, does war photography, capturing war in this way for film, is it worth it in the end? Does your film sort of stand alongside victims in that respect?
Well, I hope so. And I know Dan Fung was a very good friend and colleague of Tim's and, you know, obviously devastated by his loss. And, yeah, I mean, these films are incredibly dangerous to do. I think, you know, in a way, you're part of the war. If you like, the duty of reporting what's happening to a public is an important duty. You know, Dan Fung was really considered to be part of the gang, part of the unit, and respected as such. And, you know, it takes a hell of a lot of courage and skill, and even with all that, things can go wrong, of course.
So, yeah, absolutely.
You know, it's a huge price, but I think I think the soldiers and fighting men themselves recognise that's a legitimate thing to do and a valuable thing to do. So if you have war, I think you need witness too. Mm. You know, it's important.
Well, it's a tough category. Obviously, documentary always is, but you know, yours is a really, really powerful piece of filmmaking. The imagery, everything is there. So I wish you well on the journey. Does this mean that you're both going to the Oscars?
Oh, I hope so, yeah. That's the plan. Yeah, to find something to wear.
You've got to get something to wear, is the most thing.
Yeah. So any designers out there that fancy this is it. Kitting us out?
This tough anti-war trapped documentary. And really, you're like, Armani, come on.
Come on.
That's what it's all about. Guys, congratulations. Thank you so much for coming into Film Weekly. Congratulations on your film being Oscar nominated and out on DVD in the same week. I should imagine this is an extraordinary week in the lives of Mike Lerner and Martin Herring.
Thank you very much.
Also nominated was Chico and Rita, the animation directed by Fernando Treber and Javier Mariscal. We had them on the show when the film was released here in the UK, but it's now been Oscar nominated. So it's time to talk to the chairman of the film's producers, Cinema NX, Steve Christian. Congratulations on an Oscar nomination out of the Isle of Man.
Yeah, it's not bad, is it, Jason? It's obviously, yeah, all delighted and very, very, very thrilled.
It's not a blockbuster animation. I mean, I know you're nominated alongside like Kung Fu Panda 2, which is a blockbuster. But is it hard for, you know, yours has got full-on cartoon sex in it. It's got jazz in it. I mean, it's also got Cuba in it, which is always a bit of a touchy subject with the Americans. You wouldn't have thought a lot was in its favour, you know, against the big blockbusters.
Yeah, except, you know, it's authentic, it's genuine, it's a proper movie, it's not, you know, it's not massive, you know, big digital animation, it's a proper animated movie. So it had a lot going for it. I mean, the music is absolutely fantastic, it's just beautiful, the animation, it's traditional.
Yeah, look, I absolutely loved it, Steve. Does this mean that you go to the Oscars as the producer, executive producer? There's going to be a fight, isn't it?
Any excuse? Yeah, we might just make it over.
You'd have to get black tie and a haircut, Steve Christian.
Certainly have to get a haircut, that's for sure.
This is a step up, isn't it? You're playing with the big boys on Oscar night.
Yeah, you know, it's absolutely great that we can get some credibility for what we do. You know, we're under the radar. We're a tiny company by comparison to the competitors out there, where, you know, we sit in the middle of the Irish Sea doing our own thing, usually doing it under the radar, and to be honest, quite happy to be under the radar most of the time. But when we have to come above, you know, when we have to put our head above the parapet and we get noticed, then it's lovely to get noticed for something like this.
Yeah,
and I think it adds massively to the credibility that says, you know, that the independent can take a really good movie and can do something with it.
Yeah, because, absolutely.
Again, to get the nomination as an independent is just, you know, it's fantastic.
No, it's extraordinary. Just to clarify, was it actually made on the Isle of Man? Was some of it drawn and put together there?
Yeah, we actually had 10 or 12 trainees on the Isle of Man working on the film for about 18 months, and they were doing all of the colouring. So all of the colouring that you see in the film was all done over on the Isle of Man by a bunch of Manx kids, actually, 10 or 12 of them. We recruited them for 18 months, all on their very first movie. So you can imagine they're pretty delighted too. You know, they're fairly chuffed with life.
Wow, they're singing in Douglas tonight.
Why not?
An absolutely brilliant film, Chico and Rita. It was one of my favourite films of the year that it was released in, not just cartoons, but films. And you got to love a bit of that Cuban jazz as well, Steve. Is that your thing?
Yeah, you know what? It's the jazz that really attracted us. And I'll tell you what, you know, wait for Chico and Rita the musical. Watch this space.
Really? Exclusive. Steve, thank you very much for that. I look forward to that. I'm going to go and see that on the London stage. Steve, congratulations. See you in Cannes next year.
Cheers, Jason. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Yeah, even more animated than Chica and Rito, Zan Brooks is here to discuss the week's releases. Hello, Zan.
Hello.
We're going to look at The Descendant, starring Oscar-nominated George Clooney. We'll look at Liam Neeson in a post-plane crash with Wolves film, The Grey. Then we'll discuss Bertrand Bonello's Parisian drama, House of Tolerance. And I can tell you about Clive Owen's latest horror flick, Intruders. But let's start with The Descendants, because George Clooney received the Oscar nomination. It's also got four other nominations, directed by Alexander Payne, nominated for screenplay as well as best film. And here is a clip of George in action in Hawaii.
Caught her with a guy. What does that mean?
I was on my way to swim in the Black Point pool with Brandy, and suddenly I see Mom and some douchebag walking into a house. His house, I guess.
Just some guy. It could be anybody.
And he had his hand on her ass. It was gross.
Gorgeous, George. Is he going to win?
I think he stands a very good chance. I think it's possibly down to him or Jean Dujardin.
Jean Dujardin can do it? He's a Frenchman on Oscar night. Yeah,
I wonder if Jean may have peaked too soon with this. I mean, if you'd asked me a week ago, I'd have thought Jean Dujardin, but now I'm sort of switching back slightly towards Clooney.
I'm
very
always
good
going George on the Oscar night, on the big night. He's been there three times. Some Frenchman's not going to come along.
Yeah,
and
he's a bit of a darling, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he is. He won for Syriana way back when, and you kind of worked your way through,
That was
best
supporting, wasn't
supporting,
it?
Exactly. So you've done that. Yeah. Now you get the whole set. Almost.
Okay.
That's what I think. I think he's also rather good in this one. Compared to his other comic performances, which have always been eyebrow waggling, like Leatherheads and No Brother Where Art Thou.
He restrains it more in this. He's a dad on the road to redemption. He's a wealthy lawyer in Hawaii. He's the custodian of this stretch of virgin coastline. His wife is in a coma following a water skiing accident, and he's trying to reconnect with his two daughters, who he's largely been ignoring because of the business.
Yeah, one of whom I thought was rather unjustly ignored as a best supporting actress,
Shailene Woodley. Do you think? I wasn't entirely convinced by her. I thought that she was a little bit schooled.
Yeah, but anyway,
like
Hayley Steinfeld got one for.
But I wasn't convinced by her either.
So I thought it would be that kind
I don't
of.
Like the kids.
Let's
Jason.
Get a kids thing. No, you don't like youth.
I don't.
No, you're not on his side. You're like, you know, Arsene Wenger.
I didn't even like
Paul
youth when I was a youth.
that's true. An old head on old shoulders. The film, though, Alexander Payne, about Schmidt, election, sideways. One of my favourite kind of American filmmakers working today. What sort of form's he on here?
I'm going to break from the consensus on this. I thought this was a very smart, slick comedy drama. And yet I think that it's a bit bogus. I thought that it was playing with a stacked deck. I think it's ostensibly painting the Clooney character as this flawed, slightly bumbling, almost anti-hero.
Yeah.
And yet, in surrounding him with a great parade of doofuses, you actually end up exalting him as the hero. And without giving too much of a spoiler away, the key is when Clooney finds out that his wife was having this secret affair with this guy who he goes in search of.
Yeah.
If this guy turns out to be this sort of loving, worthy person, then he's a proper rival to Clooney. If he's an idiot, then the wife, by definition, is also a bit of an idiot for taking up with him.
Yeah.
And Clooney's great. And that, I thought, was the problem with the film.
Oh, okay. Because I never had a problem. I know there are people with problems with this film.
Yeah.
It's got a very, very good response.
Though,
oh, has
it?
No, there was quite a few critics who were kind of like, oh, no, it's all bogus.
I'm not quite as out on a limb as I thought I was.
No. Sorry about that. No, I thought you were going to say you were going to go out on a limb and say it was great.
Oh, no.
Because
I'm really so behind the curve.
Yeah. Man, people come and go. Fashion is a fickle thing.
You know, maybe I'm down on this film because until the last couple of weeks, everybody's been so up on this film. But I did think it was slightly the Hollywood equivalent of Ready Rip Jeans, that it purports to be a bit complicated, a bit nuanced, a bit messy, and actually it's incredibly neat and well ordered.
I think it's just a really nice film. Okay. I mean, I don't think in any shape or form it's a best picture.
No,
at all. But I do think it's a really sort of lovely slice of actually a world I had no idea
this
about Hawaii.
True. This is true.
I didn't know that you could fly in between the islands regularly and that there were special rates for Hawaiians.
And the weird politics of it as well.
And that they actually wore Hawaiian shirts all the time.
Yeah. All of that was good. And I like Clooney. I think he's always a sort of winning, authoritative presence in films. Mm. And he's good
I think he's
here.
Good at voiceovers as well. I know you say don't do voiceovers, but he does a lot of voiceovers in this.
Yeah.
And so I liked him in this one.
Okay.
And I like Shailene Woodley. I like the film. It made me laugh and it made me cry. It's a perfect
it's
blend
a perfect
of laugh
blend.
And tears, I would say. It made me think Billy Wilder at the time.
No, it doesn't have the bite of Billy Wilder.
No, it doesn't
at all.
Have the darkness. But there is, you know, the wife's in a coma. She's dying.
It's Billy Milder. Put that on the poster.
No, do like that. You can have that one. That's George Clooney, take him or leave him, he's going to win Best Actor. For not his best performance, but it's a nice performance, a lived-in performance. I like him. And he runs in flip-flops, not easy to do. Let's move on to Liam Neeson, who is back in a film called The Grey. Looks like he needs a snowsuit for this one.
We need a fire. Can we find food? If we don't move and work now, we're all freeze to death.
Somebody will find us.
They gotta know that plane went off the radar.
Nobody's gonna find us. Not here. We figure out what way is south and we start walking.
This will be one of those wild stories you tell at a party.
Liz, get up, get up.
Don't move. Stare right back at him.
Now, Sam, what's going on here? I didn't see this film.
Did you not?
No. So you can tell me anything you like, and I'll agree.
I was going to go off on some wild flight of fancy, but actually we'll stick with
this fine Liam Neeson in Hawaii, taking on George.
It's a Shakespearean drama in which Liam Neeson plays the Dane. No, this is Liam Neeson as a grisly action man in Alaska, whose plane crashes on his way back from the oil outpost, and he must lead his band of survivors south to safety.
What, trudging through the snow?
Trudging through the snow, trudging over ice floes, trudging up mountains, trudging through forests.
A bit touching the void, a little bit touching the void.
Yeah, it's survivalist drama. He says things like, if we don't move, we'll all freeze to death.
Yes, is this true?
I think the film takes this as its motto, and it just keeps moving, right. So it doesn't freeze.
But The Grey is a wolf.
The Grey is
a
wolf.
I did some research here.
You did, yeah. And maybe you've dropped the big spoiler.
Oh, is that, am I wrong?
No, I don't think so.
It's like Jaws. Oh my God.
The wolves appear fairly early on, and you see their yellow eyes glinting in the gloom. And then, of course, Liam has got to kind of face off against a band of mad timber wolves.
I gather there's a bit of a protest. Some people have been almost picketing. I don't know if they've gone as far as picketing, but apparently the wolf kind of posse are like saying, you know what, wolves are misunderstood and they're quite nice and they should be protected and not have to act.
Well, I think this is a bit of a political issue in America at the time when they're sort of reintroducing wolves back into, you know, the suburbs of New York.
Oh, those wolves, yeah.
Those kind of things. In this, they actually eat a wolf. At one stage.
Really?
Yeah. And apparently.
So it's a bit like Alive as well, but with
a bit
wolves.
Like, yeah, it's very like Alive. And it's very method in that the actors actually did eat, tuck into a wolf. So
Where does it say that in the film? Like at the end, an animal was eaten in the making of this
movie. I didn't
actually
stick around to see the disclaimer or the wolf recipe that they might have had at the end. I quite like this. It's a total B movie. It's directed by Joe Carnahan, who obviously made that great masterpiece, The A-Team.
Yeah, he's so overrated, Joe Carnahan, because I remember there was a few years ago.
We're going on our weird, you know, you're saying he's overrated?
Yeah, because there was this thing about, I had to go see Narc about 8 years ago. You've got to go see Narc. It's got Ray Liotta in it, and it's brilliant. This guy called Joe Carnahan, he's going to be massive. He should be Oscar nominated. Tom Cruise loves him. This is the film. I saw it, and he was like, Narc? I was well narked. I had to go and see this film, because it wasn't very good. And it's still, and then he went on to make The A-Team, and I went,
they weren't saying that about The A-Team, were they?
No, they weren't. So this is B movie by the maker of the A-Team,
and yet as B movies go, it's you know, certainly an A minus.
Right,
it's lean and mean, and has no pretensions to be anything other than the story of Liam Neeson in a woolen cap running through the snow with a wolf snapping at his heels.
So there's a bit of Essential Killing in there that's Vincent Moss's gallery.
Yes, a little bit.
No existential kind
There's no existential crisis in here. He hasn't got time for it. He's got a wolf after him.
And if he hung around pondering existential crisis, he would freeze to death.
He'd freeze or end up inside a lupine's belly.
Oh dear, we don't want anyone else co-starring, apart from the wolf, obviously.
There's some very good roles for the wolves. There's a bunch of basically fodder.
Right.
Running behind him. It's Liam's show.
Did I read Dermot Mulroney?
Yes, he's in there.
Yeah, is he the wolf?
He is the plane.
I knew one would come. That's The Grey, which actually sounds quite like fun, and I shouldn't have missed that one, but I did. You know what? We're going to move on to The House of Tolerance, or Souvenirs de la Maison Close.
Or La Polonide.
La Polonide, yeah, it's got millions of names. I think we'll go with House of Tolerance.
All right.
That's what its British title is. On the poster is a girl. I don't know if it's a girl, but someone with very sort of slim legs and frilly knickers and some pink lacy things. It's a French drama about a brothel in early 20th century Paris.
Le métier, ça prend sur le tas, il est difficile. Si ça fonctionne pas pour toi, je peux pas te garder.
T'as quel âge maintenant?
16 ans.
Pourquoi tu veux venir ici?
Pour être indépendante, être libre.
Pour être libre. On est dans une maison close ici, la liberté c'est dehors, c'est pas ici.
J'aime profondément les putains. Je les trouve merveilleuses.
It's directed by Bertrand Bonello and was in competition in Cannes last year.
It was.
I must say that its languid, opiated sexiness has stayed with me.
Those things always do.
Yeah, I can't shake them.
No, and full credit to you for not. It stayed with me too. who could have predicted that? And actually, I've done a bit of a U-turn on this because I remember seeing it in Cannes and thinking that it was a little bit dubious, thinking that it was it looks beautiful. It's like a sort of ravishing ice cream sundae that you actually eat too much and you think it's not good for me. Or it's a bit like, you know, Auguste Renoir painting the Victoria's Secret catalogue.
Yeah,
there's a lot of girls falling out of their dresses.
Yeah, which I've always thought about Degas and the keyhole pictures. You know, like it really is just kind of early
Victoria's
Secret.
It is soft porn, yeah.
Nothing wrong with soft porn.
There's nothing wrong with soft porn, and yet I kind of got on my high horse about it at Cannes and thought, should soft porn be
allowed
in competition?
Yeah, I know, I got told off by quite a lot of girls for liking this film.
And yet, maybe I'm sort of justifying it in hindsight, but I do think there's something a bit more rigorous going on here. I think that it is quite an exacting portrait of brothel life, and the brothel being both a place of commerce, a site for fantasy, a weird stage. We're talking about the names of the film, but the girls all have their own sort of names and their identity, and they're playing roles.
Yes.
But also it's a sort of locus for female friendship and female loyalty.
Yeah, because you've got the girls who all live together in a sort of frilly prison in the dormitories, and then they have to come downstairs and kind of entertain the local magistrates and kind of well-to-do clientele.
Yeah, but all of these people are very secondary. It's very much a focus on the women and their interrelationships, and it doesn't shy away from the obvious downside of brothel life, be it brutality.
Yeah.
There's a girl who has her face slashed in this, syphilis, and just the oppressive.
And rents.
And rent, absolutely. And it is the last days of this little world.
It's a sort of, does it? It harks back. I mean, it's an odd thing to hark back to, but it's the sort of where are the brothels of yesteryear kind of thing. I mean, because at the end, we this is no spoiler, but we kind of come out and we look at what we would call sex workers today.
Yeah.
This is the day when courtesans, prostitutes was an art form for both gentlemen of leisure and for women. They were heroines of Maupassant. They featured in Flaubert. They were often painted by Monet and the Impressionists and Degas. So,
and within this shadowy world, they had a weird status.
Yes.
And they had certainly there was an obligation to make sure that they were well tended, even though there's sort of horrors going on there too. So it's certainly not, it's not judgmental either way, but it is a portrait of a world that surprisingly enough, I know nothing about.
But and I think you would have if you were.
Would I now?
If you were growing, if you were in a Flaubert novel.
If I was in a Flaubert novel, I would, yes.
I liked it very much. I think it's a kind of drama that's a workplace documentary in a way as well.
And also, I love the anachronistic soundtrack that he uses, which
kind
is a big gamble, but it pays fantastic
Nights
dividends.
Nights in White Satin.
Nights in White Satin and Bad Girl by Lee Moses, which is a song that I didn't know before. It's this sort of real dirty R&B soul from the 60s that works so well.
It doesn't work when Madonna used Pretty Vacant last week in
It didn't
in
at
WWE,
all,
no.
But this somehow fits perfectly.
Because it's for the age. I like it. And also, look, I'm not going to lie, it's quite sexy.
It is sexy.
The
even though there's
sexy.
No not much actual sex in there.
No, but it's all suggested. I mean, it's all flirt and drinking and sitting on, draping on the armchair and all
it
of
is,
that.
It is, yeah.
The House of Tolerance by Bertrand Bonello. Sam, I've just time to tell you that Clive Owen is back.
Yes, this is the film that I didn't see this week.
Yeah, it's called Intruders. Mm. And I can't believe it, because there's always a joke about how did this intruder get in there? Well, intruder window. How does this intruder get into Clive Owen's house?
Is it?
Intruder
Do
window.
You think that was the starting point?
Well, I don't
film.
Know, because it was made by Juan Carlos Fresnadillo. Yeah. And I don't reckon he's much for your English puns. although he is the guy that made the zombie sequel 28 Weeks Later.
Yeah, which I really didn't like, but he also did Intacto, didn't he?
Yeah, which was really
great.
Good.
Yeah.
The Running Through the Forest and that Strange Island. That was a really good film. And he seems to have gone off the boil here, because here's a sort of J-horror was the Japanese thing where water used to come through the ceiling and there was always a dripping tap and a girl with black hair and someone in the telly. All those tropes are now, I think, have been transferred to L horror, or I'm going to call Latin horror, which Guillermo del Toro seems to have the kind of monopoly on. And, you know, there must be a disappeared kid from an orphanage appearing on a beach. There's all of that in here as well. For some reason, Clive Owen is a welder on a skyscraper in the city of London. Cue lots of shots taken from the beginning of The Apprentice, where they just fly over the city of London. And you expect Lord Sugar to say, send him in there, love. But they don't. They send Clive Owen in. And his daughter's 12 years old. She's having nightmares because she's found a scrap of paper hidden in the tree of her grandma's house. house, and she's dreamt up this figure called Hollow Face, who comes, has no face, but comes to steal the faces of children so that he might have a face of his own. Why? Is he really in her room? Clive Owen runs in his pyjamas to tackle this man. And if there isn't a man in this room, why is he running out of the window to chase this bloke down the street? Is he going mad? It's another of Clive Owen's concerned dad roles.
Yeah.
Because he did The Boys Are Back.
He did The Boys Are Back.
And the one with David Schwimmer made, Trust.
Trust.
Where he hunted down the
pedophile. I
always
find him a bit of Hollow Face.
Old Clive. You just watch it thinking, oh, you were so touted for the Bond, and now you're not. Now you're running around after ghosts in J horror.
It's a living.
It is a living. It's not a great film. I've got to tell you, it's overdone. And horror has a unique ability to be frightening, even though it's completely rubbish. So there's all scary music, and someone's going to be behind the door. Don't close the fridge. There's going to be someone. And then you get to the end of all of these kind of, oh, actually, there wasn't. And you just feel so hollow and cheated by the end, because then they do always try and explain it. And they go, well, actually, it was a sort of phantasmagory in his head all along. And it was like, you know, Patrick Duffy in the shower. I was dreaming. It was a nightmare. You just go, oh, bollocks. I've sat through this, and that's just bollocks. It has no other genre can do that to me.
And this is your key sticking point with the horror genre.
Yeah, often it's bollocks.
Yeah, it's bollocks. Yeah. It doesn't actually add up.
Yeah,
there are no such things as ghosts. You scream.
No ghosts, I say. But I don't mind Devil Children, Omen, and things like that.
Oh yeah,
Raven,
there are such things as Devil Children. I've met them.
Yes, well, I've taught some of them.
They're all out in West London.
That is Clive Owen's Intruders. And Zan, thank you very much for your reviews and for your Oscar chat, for all of Zan's musings, videos, writings, thinkings and scribblings about the world of film. Go to guardian.co.uk/film.
So won't you please just take,
I thought I understood it,
my hand,
but I didn't, not really,
and take my
only the smudgeness of it, the eagerness of it, the idea of it, of you and me.
Like Crazy is a lovable, comedic, sprawling film in the classic indie talkie mould of Hal Hartley, Woody Allen and Richard Linklater. Directed and written by Drake Doremus, it stars the excellent British actress Felicity Jones as a student in LA who, having fallen in love with a handsome furniture designer, Anton Yelchin, outstays her visa for a summer of love and finds herself caught in a love trap. A tortuous London-LA romance ensues, set to the sounds of visas being refused, wedding bells, affairs, heartaches, tears, and lots of Paul Simon. So I'm delighted to say that the film's creator, Drake Doremus, joins me on the line from Los Angeles now. Welcome to Film Weekly, Drake. Congratulations on Like Crazy. What's with all the Paul Simon?
Paul Simon's definitely, you know, my favorite artist growing up and was a big part of my childhood. So in thinking nostalgically back at relationships that I'd had growing up, Paul Simon was a big part of that. So sort of it became the aesthetic and soundtrack and backdrop for the film.
Tell me about the film, Drake. I mean, how did you cast Felicity Jones? She's an actress that we've long admired on this show. We've had her on a couple of times. She's been bubbling under. This is the biggest thing that I've seen her do in terms of she's on screen for so much of the time and is so superb in it. Where did you get hold of her and how did you cast her?
It was a really lucky circumstance. I mean, I was completely unaware of her, and she sent me a tape from London. I'd never met her in person, and her tape was just so extraordinary. I asked her to come to LA and be in the movie, and I cast her without even meeting her.
Wow.
So it was a really strange circumstance. I mean, I cast her probably about a week or two before we started shooting. I mean, it was very late in the process, and I had seen an enormous amount of British actresses in Los Angeles, and it just wasn't feeling right. And I got a tape from her in London. She gave it a whirl, and she did an amazing job.
I mean, it's interesting because when talking about your film, I've compared it to the films that I love, films that are just about people kind of walking and talking quite often. Yours is flying and talking on the phone and across time zones, but essentially it's that kind of movie. What were the templates for it when you discussed with Felicity? You were sort of, I mentioned to her Annie Hall, and she was like, oh, God, Annie Hall, enough already with Annie Hall, which has Paul Simon in it. Let's actually, now we think about it. But, you know,
very, very long-haired Paul Simon.
Yeah, Tony Lacey, the record producer he plays. Great. Anyway, we digress. Yeah. She was like, yeah, Annie Hall, whatever. You know. So what were the other filmic templates for Like Crazy?
I mean, we talked about Breaking the Waves a lot, actually.
Really?
The performances in that film and how unbelievably truthful they are. And And movies like Y Tu Mama Tambien sort of look back on something nostalgically in a way that's very true and real and honest. And, you know, those movies, I think more than any other movies, really were.
You know, it's obviously a kind of personal project, so intimate between you know, Anton and Felicity, that working together like that. And you obviously, as director, just from looking at the movie, where you were kind of there the whole time. It doesn't look like it was a big crew. It seems like a very intimate bit of work. Was it intense like that, or did you have fun, or did you improvise much? Was it all kind of scripted and you had to be very quick with this shoot?
I mean, it was very fast. We had 24 days to do it. We shot in LA for 3 weeks, and then we went to London and shot for a week, which was an extraordinary experience. And we had an incredibly small crew. I mean, we had 10, 15 people on set at the most, and a lot of the film was improvised. I mean, a lot of what we were doing through the rehearsal process was just trying to sort of organically find the characters and let them blossom in a very natural way. And the improv element was a big part of that, and trying to find the chemistry between Anton and Felicity was paramount, and luckily they had it and cultivated it.
I mean, normally you, Margaret Thatcher, you get an American actress to play, you know, our kind of titanic figure of 80s politics. So Meryl Streep's come over to do Margaret Thatcher, but you stuck with a British actress. There was no chance you were going to use an American actress. It was always going to be a romance between an English girl and an American boy, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, the most important thing was for the actors to come on set and lose themselves in these characters, and they would have to authentically live it from the inside out, and if they weren't really from there, it wasn't going to work. So
yeah,
pretty much from the beginning, I knew I needed to have an authentically British actress.
It's almost a kind of raw performance from both of them. They're both kind of very open to the manipulation of the piece, if you see what I mean. They're both kind of almost bleeding at a point. Your heart really goes out to them. Was that something that you had to work on? Is that always there in the script, or did you have to sort of describe to them, you know, how that was going to happen in terms of, you know, the direction that you wanted it to go?
Well, I mean, right from the start, we kind of made a commitment that we were all going to sort of fade into the fabric of this piece, and it was going to be about the piece, and it wasn't going to be about anybody individually. And they bought into the process immediately and gave themselves to it and trusted me and trusted the process and trusted each other. And I think that's really evident in the film, because the line of division between when they step on set and when they step off is not very apparent. It's all very unbelievably natural. So it's a huge credit to Anton and Felicity for just pulling themselves, and Jennifer Lawrence and Charlie Bewley and Alex Kingston and all the great actors in the film, who just really gave themselves to the process.
Have you got a girlfriend squirreled away here in London that you're not allowed to see? Is this the personal starting point for the movie? Can I bring you together? Can I help you guys in some way?
Yeah. I was in a long relationship with a woman from overseas who's not from England, actually. It's from a different country. And, you know, there's experiences I've had going back and forth and in a long-distance relationship between Los Angeles and Europe. And it's just a really personal experience to me, something that I know really well. So in making the film, it was really sort of easy to fall back on that experience and try to tell it as authentically as I had experienced.
Did you have visa issues too?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, wow. Because that's the bit you kind of think, oh, don't do it. Your visa, you know, when you're there and you're having a lovely summer of love and you think, whatever, the visa thing. But you just say, no, don't do that. And I love that in romantic comedy, romantic films. You know, you kind of stop them doing stuff because they're doing stupid things for love. So you did that.
Yeah, it's the worst. I mean, you can't control it. It's like an illness, love. It takes hold of you and won't let go. And I think that's one of the things that the movie's about.
For me, it's kind of what indie filmmaking is all about. I really appreciate it and enjoyed it immensely, not just Felicity, but also the Paul Simon. Anton Yelchin's great in it too. And the whole atmosphere of LA, you really capture that beautifully. And the London bit too, even when it's in LA. So
thank you, Jason.
Congratulations.
So much, man. I really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Drake.
All right, cheers.
And Like Crazy is on release in the UK from this Friday, the 27th of January. And that brings us to an end for this edition of Film Weekly. Thanks to all my guests, to Drake Doremus, director of Like Crazy, to the producer of Chico and Rita, Steve Christian, and those guys behind Helen Back Again, Mike Lerner and Martin Herring. Congratulations to you. We are crossing our fingers for you all on Oscar night. The music we've been listening to on this show is from Like Crazy. Until next week, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on this edition of Film Weekly, Ian Chambers, it's goodbye.
For For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.